I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. That was Eunice Kennedy Shriver's rallying cry at the first Special Olympics in 1968. Since then, the Special Olympics and its message of inclusion for those with intellectual disabilities has gone global. In a new memoir, Timothy Shriver, son of Eunice and Sergeant Shriver, traces his family's legacy as advocates for people with special needs. At the heart of the story is Rosemary Kennedy, the third of nine Kennedy children whose intellectual disability was long a shame and a secret, but whose life had a significant effect on millions of people. Timothy Shriver, chairman of the Special Olympics, joins me in Studio A after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Of all the Kennedys who have made their way into the history books over the years, Rosemary's is perhaps the least well-known story. Rosemary Kennedy was the third of nine Kennedy children born to Joseph and Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy. And unlike her precocious siblings, she was born with intellectual disabilities. She was born at the height of the eugenics movement, when people who considered themselves progressives supported selective breeding and sterilization as a way of improving the genetic features of the human race. For many years, Rosemary's condition was kept secret, hidden from the public and even from the family's close friends. Then in 1941, Rosemary Kennedy, at the age of 23, underwent a lobotomy at the direction of her father. At the time, the surgery was experimental and promised a cure for her emotional problems. Only the surgery was a disaster and left her with limited verbal and motor abilities. She spent the rest of her life with nuns and caregivers in Wisconsin. Today on the show, we have the pleasure of speaking with Rosemary's nephew, Timothy Shriver, whose new memoir is called Fully Alive, Discovering What Matters Most. It offers new insight into Rosemary Kennedy's life, and it also gives us an idea of how Rosemary Kennedy's story affected her siblings and millions of people with special needs. Timothy Shriver's mother, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, founded the Special Olympics. In fact, the movement can be traced to the family's backyard in suburban Maryland in Montgomery County. And Timothy Shriver's uncle, President John F. Kennedy, signed groundbreaking legislation to create funding for research and services for people with intellectual disabilities. Timothy Shriver is also closely linked with the cause. For more than a decade, he's been the chairman of Special Olympics, and his memoir details his own journey, how he got involved, and how the many Special Olympians he's met over the years have continued to influence his outlook on life. A quote from the book: "To live fully alive is to do what so many of these athletes have done, face the fear, whatever fear lies within each of us and within our countries, and in facing it, break its hold and defeat it. And when that fear is defeated, we are free to be ourselves, to pursue our unique gifts and dreams, to find places and people to whom we belong and with whom we are affirmed, and together with them, to give ourselves unselfishly to life." Timothy Shriver, welcome to Studio A here at Midday at WYPR.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Over the years, various things have been written about the Kennedy family. A lot has been written about the Kennedy family, and some members of the family themselves have written about their lives. How much has been written prior to this about Rosemary?
Well, not a lot. Most of it has been of the order of, I would say kind of mean-spirited accusations leveled at my grandfather for his decision to have her undergo the surgery. The most important missing piece, however, isn't that Rosemary has never been mentioned. It's that she's never been mentioned positively. Even when listening to your introduction, a listener might think, my God, this is a horror story. This is a period of eugenics. This is a period of horrific treatment. This is a period when this operation takes place, when people were put in institutions, lost, forgotten. The premise of this book is in a way that from that comes an extraordinary burst of life energy from her gentleness, from her kindness, from her openness, from her trust, from her brothers and her sisters and the love they shared and the loyalty they learned. Came this flourishing of extraordinary energy, positive energy, life-giving energy. We are here now in a season where we're all sort of celebrating big life gifts, whether we come from religious traditions or not, the idea of celebrating our families, our brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren. We want to give them something that will make them feel, if you will, fully alive. The irony is that Rosemary, the hidden, the forgotten, the silenced member of that family, in my view, was the wellspring of that kind of energy.
When you were a kid growing up, the son of Eunice and Sergeant Shriver, what were you told about her, and what was your experience with Rosemary?
Well, by the time I came along, it was the 1960s, and my mother wrote an article for the Saturday Evening Post, a very important article in that era, disclosing the fact that the President of the United States, then President Kennedy, had a sister with an intellectual disability. She told this story openly for the first time in the history of the family, that Rosemary was a valued part of the family. So by the time I came along, my mother had, in effect, decided, like every great social movement, it needed people who would break the secret. The image we have from the LGBT community of coming out of the closet is a powerful one, I think, resonates with this movement. She allowed Rosemary out of the family closet, out of the shame closet, if you will, and into the broad of daylight. So for me, I was a little boy, and Rosemary would come four or five times a year to visit, and she'd spend a week with us, and I'd come home from school, and there she'd be, and she'd play cards and have dinner and take a walk, and in the summer, we'd go for a swim together. She didn't say much, but, she was the person in our house, in a house very busy, very ambitious, very competitive. She's the person who never asked you what grade you got on a test, never asked you whether you'd written a book or given a speech. She was just there. And I don't think I saw it at the time. What does a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old know of these big themes? But a 6 or an 8-year-old does experience something different. And as I went to write this book, I thought to myself, wow, she's the only person I can ever remember coming into my house whose track record didn't matter. She wasn't judged based on what office she held. And in Washington, D.C., in a culture that consumes people because of their power and spits them out when they're powerless, she was powerless, but she had power in our house. And it was a beautiful thing to remember the influence she had on all of us.
Timothy Shriver, you write in the book, "In her own way, Rosemary may have had the most influence of any member of my family because her message was by far the most radical. She was the only person I ever met who didn't need to do anything to prove she mattered. In the midst of an enormously competitive family system, Rosemary Kennedy lived a full life to the age of 86 without ever giving a speech, writing a book, holding a job, or garnering the praise of the mighty. I envied her deeply." She lived until 2005, at the age of 86. She was born in 1918. Given what you know about the way people treated, cared for, or didn't care for people who were born, to use the term from back then, mentally retarded, is what Rose and your grandparents, Rose and Joseph Kennedy, did all that unusual?
I think it was, most families in that age would have given their child to an institution, particularly wealthy families who could afford it. They could remove the child from the light of day, avoid any embarrassment, avoid any humiliation, avoid any additional burden. Doctors would have told mothers that this is the best for you, that mothers who kept their children were considered to be bad mothers, that they would be flawed mothers, that they wouldn't care for their other children, that they'd be distracted by their child with special needs. So in the face of all that, Joe and Rose Kennedy, a man and a woman of means with a large, growing family, very ambitious, made the alternate choice, which was to keep her at home and tell their brothers and sisters, you take care of Rosemary, you look out for Rosemary, you include Rosemary, you care for Rosemary. That was, in a way, the most, I think, important decision they made as parents, because it allowed the description you just gave, a woman who didn't have to earn the love of her parents or the love of her brothers and sisters. Now, some people might say, well, this is a book about people with special needs. This is a book about the history of this family. But when I hear you even now reading back that short section of the book, she didn't have to do anything to prove she mattered. It just reminds me, even though I wrote it, I have to be reminded that that's a way of living, you know, that we have some, maybe if we're lucky, one or two relationships in our lives where we don't have to prove anything to prove we matter. And that is a rare gift to give to someone, to love them without conditions. Maybe moms and dads do that. Maybe they think they do it. But oftentimes, that is an arc. And this book is, in a way, an attempt to invite people into that arc of change so that we can find that alternate space where we don't judge each other based on wealth or power or performance, but we love one another based on none of that.
I like this quote from your mother in the book when you talk to your mother, Eunice Shriver, about Rosemary. "My parents always told us, remember, Rosemary is our sister, and you always look out for your sister. Never leave her out. All eight were confused and conflicted about their sister. They had to be. She was accepted, but sometimes rejected, a part of the family, but sometimes apart. She was different, and all the children had to learn what to make of difference."
I think, you know, when you have a brother or sister who the world judges as being a liability, as being a defective, as being an invalid, as being all these horrible, horrible words, and yet you love that person. I mean, at some level, you know he or she is a beautiful human being. You grow up in this vortex of love and fight. You know, love, am I embarrassed? You know, one young man told me, you know, everybody would always ask me what was wrong with my brother. And it wasn't until I was 19 years old that I could finally know the answer. Nothing is wrong with my brother. My brother has Down syndrome. There's not a thing wrong with him. But the world tells us there's things wrong with all of us, you know. And in brothers and sisters in this family, I had to figure out what to make of this, that they loved this woman, this child, this sister. And yet, everywhere she went, she didn't fit. Every doctor my grandmother called said, we have nothing. Every school, we have nothing. Every daycare center, we have nothing. You know, the world didn't want her, and yet they loved her. And so they learned, I think, in this very powerful way that love has to overcome what the world tells you. You know, you have to fight when the world tells you no. And I think, in part, that's what they brought to politics, was a sense in which the outsider, the vulnerable person in society, belongs, deserves the chance, has great gifts to give, but we're going to fight. We're going to stop at nothing to prove that he or she belongs. Where else could they have learned that lesson as powerfully as they learned it from their own sister? Where else can each of us learn that lesson more powerfully than by looking at our friends, our neighbors, our own family members who may be outside the circle of power, outside the circle of importance, and find ways to include them and recognize them for who they are, regardless of whatever differences they might have?
So that goes back to the childhood of your mother and her siblings. There came a time, of course, when Rosemary wasn't around anymore. We'll talk about that. But I'm struck by this. It sounds like you had a bit of an epiphany about where Kennedy family sense of service came from, noblesse oblige. I believe it was from caring for her that they all gained the confidence to believe that they could ask others to give, knowing the joys of giving. I believe it was from playing with her that they learned the meaning of the faith in which they were raised, of being a part of something bigger and more mysterious than any book can teach.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
an epiphany for you?
I set out to write a book about how wonderful the athletes of Special Olympics are and continue to be. I wanted to write about a guy like Eddie Barbanel, who's a screen actor, who's an advocate for fighting the use of the R word, who's funny, who's smart, who's a great, great friend. The more I tried to write about Eddie, and Donald Page is in this book, and Daniel Thompson, whose faith was extraordinary to me in the face of a cancer diagnosis, all these, but I had to sort of prove to the reader, if you will, that why these people matter to me. And that my editor kept saying to me, you know, you're going to have to show your own arc of change here if you're going to convince the reader that they should care, because otherwise it's just going to be a story about an organization. So I had to make it a story about personal transformation, which is ultimately, I think, what I hope it is and what I hope it invites other people to, a deepening. So I kept going back, and I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to write about the Kennedy family, and that's, and then I don't want to write about Rosemary, and that's so self-absorbed, and people are going to get distracted. And, of course, they have gotten a little bit distracted by the Kennedy salacious part of that story. But ultimately, I hope the book is an invitation into mystery, into compassion, into a generosity of spirit, into an openness and trust in the world. You know, to me, that's what's missing in politics. That's what's missing in the culture. If you look at a magazine stand and ask yourself the question, what is this magazine stand telling me about how to find what matters most? The answer will be beauty, money, fame, attention, celebrity.
Celebrity.
That's
yeah.
what's going to make me happy. And I mean, I had all that growing up,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I found what mattered most, in the most unlikely places, but those were places of interior transformation, deep relationship, powerful happiness, and a good time.
But that part about your mother and her siblings, do you think, I mean, is this something that occurred to you in the process of this
yes,
book or
no,
something
I,
you thought about before?
Well, I wondered about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I have the joy of being able to travel into many parts of the country and in other parts of the world, too, on this issue of disability rights. And people always come up to me saying, I so admire your uncle for this or for that other thing. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, what is it that, you know, I mean, I know there's a big narrative here, but what is the source of this resilient attraction to their kind of politics? Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or like everything about them or not is not the point. But there is some sense in which my uncles, Ted Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy, continue to speak to people in different parts of the world, continue to inspire them. And I thought to myself, what the heck is it? You know, I mean, they gave good speeches, but a lot of politicians give good speeches. They held high office, but a lot of people hold high office. So, you know, the more I dug into it, the more I thought, you know, there was a mysterious trust in looking out for those who are vulnerable. There was this sense of confidence they had, this enormous resolve and fight. You know, when my Uncle Bobby went and visited the Willowbrook State Institution and walked out and declared it a snake pit, if you look at his face, you see a man shaken. You don't see a man with a speechwriter.
That was up on Long Island. I remember that.
In New York.
You
don't see a consultant.
Yeah.
You don't see a handler. You see a human being shaken by human, almost, I would say, evil. He had to have felt some resonance there with his own sister. Just as President Kennedy, when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, he must have felt at some level, I'll never be able to prove it, that if he asked the country to give, that people would enjoy it tremendously. Because when he'd been asked to give, in the most primitive and most powerful moment in his life as a child, when he'd been asked to give to his own sister, he must have known he had a great time.
Timothy Shriver is our guest. When we take a little break here and come back and talk some more, we'll talk about the Special Olympics and more about Rosemary, too. Timothy Shriver, chair of the Special Olympics, out with a new memoir. It's called Fully Alive. You'll hear him use that term a few times during this hour. Fully Alive, Discovering What Matters Most. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here, speaking with Special Olympics chair Timothy Shriver. How long have you held that position, by the way, actually chairman of the board?
That's a good question. Let's see, 2000. I think it's about 10 years.
About 10 years.
You said 10 years. Yeah, I think it's 2004.
Your mother, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, founded that organization in the late 1960s. So I want to talk just a little bit more about the other part of Rosemary Kennedy's life, and then we'll move on and talk about the Special Olympics and how all that came to be with your mother. I asked you before what Joseph Kennedy and Rosemary Kennedy did in terms of their daughter, Rosemary. How unusual was it? It sounds like they tried to send her to schools, for one thing, for a while, just to carry on as if she wasn't different in any way.
Well, they did what any parent would do today, which is they've got a child and they look out and try to find a place where their child will fit in. For their eight of their children, that seemed relatively straightforward. The schools in Boston and the private schools that they ended up going to were fine. For Rosemary, there wasn't a place where she fit in. But all of us as parents, you know, nowadays we have so much of a deeper understanding of children and all their differences. We're trying to find a way for our children to fit in. What's the right school? What's the right after-school program? What's the right sport? What's the right musical instrument? What's the right group of friends? What's the right neighborhood? Who's the gang? So that's what they did with their daughter. I hope other parents will see in this story their own search for places. The problem they had was And again, many parents still face this. They looked around and they didn't find any place for their daughter. My mother would tell the story well into her 80s of seeing her own mother put the phone down. She would gesture. She put the phone down and she would turn to me and she'd say, "There's nothing for Rosemary. Nothing. Hmm. Nothing. Nothing." You know, no one cared about their daughter, you know. And what a profoundly painful experience that is.
You mean nothing besides an institution? Because an institution would have been
Correct, a
choice, and they tried not. Sounds like they tried not to make that choice.
Yeah, we don't know. There's no record of them formally looking at an institution. At least I couldn't find one. I'm not a historian, but I know of no evidence that they explored a specific institution. But they moved her around from school to school, from tutor to tutor, from homeschooling opportunities, from convent to all kinds of different things, and various doctors recommended various treatments. You know, this is in a way a story of the dangers also of medicine. I mean, medicine has done extraordinary things for people, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. But in this particular era, medicine was no friend of people with intellectual disabilities. It led the eugenics movement. It led the forced sterilization movement. It championed this lobotomy treatment. Won the Nobel Prize. The people who developed this therapy, so to speak, which was enormously irresponsible.
Let's talk about that for a minute. The idea was that there could be a cure for emotional cognitive problems through lobotomy.
Yeah.
I remember the phrase. I think from a book that I read, lobotomy gets them home, meaning people who have a lobotomy can become more manageable or can live a more normal life, do not have to live in an institution, can actually live with you at home. Just one thing I remember from my readings of the lobotomy movement.
But the whole science, I mean, look, the sad truth is that the Nazi doctors during the trials in Nuremberg claimed as part of their defense that they had studied from and practice the skills that they learned from institutions in the state of California in the United States in the teens. That's where they went to train.
During the progressive movement in this
country. The progressive movement, yeah. the ascendancy of the scientific treatment of intellectual disabilities. And that's where it led us. It led us to devalue human beings in the most profound and possibly the most enduring image of evil we have in history. So we have to be careful about how we evaluate one another, and we have to be careful about how we make judgments about whose life matters and whose doesn't, whose is worth living and whose isn't. To the extent there's a little part in each of us who feels unworthy, and there's a little part in each of our children and our brothers and sisters and our best friends who feels ashamed of who we are, we carry with us that enormous fear that someone in judging us will want to exclude us. That if we're ever seen for who we are, we will be eliminated. We will be thought to be unworthy of friendship, of love, of affection, of belonging. The great story here is those human beings who have faced that, who have faced being excluded and told they don't belong, and who at the same time find within themselves this great reservoir of strength and joy and happiness and trust, and can remind us all that we are all worthy and deserving of belonging, and that the great mission of politics, of culture, of religion, is to broaden the circle of inclusion to include everyone and give everyone a place. You know, that's a lesson for our families now. Loretta Claiborne in this book teaches it.
Well, we're gonna talk about her. There's several people, Special Olympians, that you profile in the book as well. Again, Timothy Shriver is our guest here at Midday. His book is Fully Alive, Discovering What Matters Most. Just one last thing about Rosemary Kennedy. The period when after the lobotomy, what can you tell us about that, when Joseph Kennedy and your grandfather and grandmother decided to send her away sometime after?
Well,
that?
It's a guess. I'm assuming with a lot of confidence that the pain my grandfather felt was unending for what happened. There's no way, no evidence that anything could have been attributed to malice. I mean, it was a wonderful, in some ways, point in Rosemary's life. He and she had been together in London before the war, the two of them.
He was ambassador.
He was the ambassador to the court of St. James. And many of the rest of the family had come home, but Rosemary stayed there with her dad, and they exchanged wonderful letters. She was a tutor outside of London and living in with nuns, and she was flourishing, very happy. And he was thrilled and grateful and wrote wonderful letters to the nuns of gratitude and to her. So, I mean, he was trying to help her. And I just think when he realized the results of what happened, he couldn't face it. So, you know, a few years later, he decided to dedicate his philanthropic, what became the Kennedy Foundation, to this cause. He wrote to others that that this cause would be the mission of the Kennedy family. It wasn't the mission that became known publicly. Politics was, as and still is, seen as the primary agenda of that family. But the fight for the dignity of people with intellectual disabilities, the fight in honor of Rosemary's life, has become, it's a little bit the tortoise and the hare in a way. This is the part of the family's work that might be very much more tortoise than hare, but I think it will endure long for many, many years. I see around the world still people coming to this movement through the Special Olympics movement, through my brother's organization, Best Buddies, through the fellowships that the Kennedy Foundation still sponsors, and having eye-opening moments where they sort of see the world differently. And that's to be fully alive. You know, I ask people when I've been traveling around the last month, you know, what makes you feel fully alive? And it's almost always, an answer is almost always a flash, a moment in which the world seemed to work, you know, in which they felt like they were no longer afraid, mm-hmm. and in which they felt so deeply connected to a child, to a friend, to a colleague. I think this will continue to happen in honor of Rosemary around the world for decades to come. And so in some ways, my grandfather dedicating his own foundation, and my mother, of course, deciding to lead that with all the vigor that she could muster for the every day of her life, that this will become, in some ways, one of the, if not the lasting legacy of this family, certainly one of them.
Her father asked Eunice Kennedy Shriver, your mother, to lead the foundation.
She did.
Right.
He did, and she did. She kind of asked him to ask her. My mother was a force. You know, there was a beautiful quote I heard the other day, a blizzard of one. She was sort of a blizzard of one, relentless. You know, members of of President Kennedy's office were afraid of her. Politicians would rather do what she wanted than take a meeting. People that worked for her would have insomnia with trying to keep up with her. I mean, she just was on a mission. She saw that the world could be different. And every day for her was unfinished business.
October 1961, I want to talk about this next in the chronology. President Kennedy officially announces the creation of the historic President's Panel on Mental Retardation. So can you connect the story you've told so far about your family, Rosemary, and Eunice, your mother, to that?
Well, you know, my mother and President Kennedy, I think, both saw the election, the presidential, the ascendancy, if you will, to the presidency as a moment of opportunity, something that they'd never felt before. And so my mother quickly moved after the inauguration to ask her brother for support to embark on work to figure out what the federal government could do. At that point, the federal government was doing almost nothing, no research, very little in the terms of care, nothing almost in terms of education. Nothing in terms of employment, community living, nothing. I mean, really, the federal government had no role. So she set out, and the choice was made to create a panel. She met with former President Hoover, who had been on a very well-known commission, and President Hoover said, this is a great idea, have a panel, convene all the scientists, create a boilerplate plan, and send it to the Congress and get legislation passed. And so she did, and the chairman of that panel said, you know, he pulled the president aside at the first meeting. They had an informal meeting and asked the president, what was his goals, and the president sort of responded, and Leonard Mayo said, well, it seems to me, Mr. President, that you want to make this your agenda. President Eisenhower, I think he were alluded to, had focused on cancer, President Roosevelt on a physical disability and polio. Is this true, Mr. President, saying to President Kennedy? And President Kennedy turned to him and said, yes, this is exactly what I want my legacy to be in this area. So that panel worked like crazy and launched the legislative, it was the tipping point, if you will, to use the modern mm-hmm. language, and ushered in a whole new era that we all take for granted now, inclusive education, inclusive support for employment, deinstitutionalization, research, medical care, clinical support. I mean, it's not enough, But it started right there in 1962 with my mother and President Kennedy.
You mentioned education. So yeah. did special education come from this?
Well, the beginnings of it did. The beginnings. The ultimate, the big law, 94-142, didn't pass for another 10 years. But the beginnings of support for inclusive education came out of the panel's reports. The panel does recommend changes. And during President Johnson's tenure, after the NICHD, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, was created, again, to support women and children's issues. There was no attention to any of that at the National Institutes of Health before this. So there was the health care, there was the education, there was the clinical training and support initiatives. There was the beginning of all these things in this era.
You know, if this were to happen today, you'd hear the president say, my own sister, yeah. make a reference to a family member or something to personalize it, humanize it. Do yeah. you know, did President Kennedy ever acknowledge Rosemary?
He authorized the publication of the article in the Saturday Evening Post.
Oh,
in
you
which,
did mention that, yeah.
Which my mother disclosed it. I did find in one of his campaign speeches in 1962, where he's in Ohio talking on behalf of the then incumbent governor who would go on to defeat in the upcoming November election in 1962, and he said, you know, those of us who have seen children live in the shadows know that this country. He goes on, but he uses those words, those of us who have seen. He's referring to the horrific treatment of people with intellectual disabilities. So he alludes cryptically, I would say, to his own experience of having seen a child live in the shadows. The only person that meets that description is his own sister, Rosemary.
Timothy Shriver is our guest in this hour of Midday. We're going to take another break here. We'll come back and talk some more. When we do, I want to ask you about some of the other people in your book whose names are not Kennedy. Loretta Claiborne. Baby Pearl, is it Donal Page?
Donald
yeah. Page.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Daniel Thompson. We'll try to get to all of them.
All of them. Fully alive.
We'll see if we can. Timothy Shriver's book is Fully Alive. This is Midday, and this is how you reach us. If you'd like to join our conversation or have a question for our guest, Timothy Shriver, the local number 410-662-8780. Toll free long distance for the Midday Show, 866-661-9309, in our Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. An email from one of our listeners, Carol, for Tim Shriver. She says, as a Baltimorean whose daughter is a Special Olympian and a delight, I am so grateful for the Special Olympics for, among so much, the opportunity it provides for friendships for teenagers and young adults. It may feel to some that special education has been around forever, but your story shows that we are not that many years from the times of not accepting or including those with intellectual disabilities. Special education through inclusion or special programs is still a work in progress. Thank you for your good work.
Thanks.
Our email address is midday@wypr.org if you want to message Tim Shriver while he's with us in the studio. So how did the Special Olympics come about, 1968?
Well, you know, it's a great story because it reminds us what's best about sports, but it came from an unlikely place. I mean, my mother, together with the city of Chicago, decided to call an athletic event. She'd realized by then, because she'd experimented in her own backyard, she realized by then that sports made a huge difference in human development. And I think we've even forgotten this with our own children, with our own lives, you know, the health status of the United States. I mean, we have so many issues that are related to the lack of physical activity. And we think of it as peripheral or supplemental, or it's not math and reading, and schools shouldn't be bothered with it. But the truth is, and she knew this early on, that to get out and play is to learn, to get out and move your body is to become more physically alert, more mentally and cognitively focused. And she saw that with children with intellectual disabilities. So she said, let's have a big Olympic event. So they went out to Chicago and Soldier Field, and the place was empty. At 1,000 people came, athletes on the field. They came from institutions, from Canada, from the United States, from homes. I captured the story of one or two of them who were there. Rafer Johnson, the great decathlete, was there. Other celebrities from the Chicago Bears and places like that were there. And the irony was that when all those people from the hidden part, from the closets of our lives, were given the chance to run and play, they did it with the kind of exuberance, the raw, authentic joy, the happiness, the trust, the sense of what matters most in sports. they brought it out like nobody ever did. All the Rafer Johnson said, "I'm looking out here and I'm seeing smiles that the world had never seen."
Hmm.
And you know, one of the races, which we don't know who was in it, but one of the runners was, you know, they were coming down the back stretch in a sprint, and one of the runners falls down, and the runner in second place, rather than cruising right past him to the finish line and coming in first, stops, turns around, walks back. So imagine, you've spent your whole life in a hidden place, you get your one chance, you're in a stadium, you're running a race, and you see the finish line, and you can cross it in first, and you can get cheered, and you can put your arms up in the air, and instead you pause, stop, turn around, and go back and pick up your friend who's on the mat, and put his arm around your shoulder and cross the finish line in last place. There is some beauty in life that we are all looking for, that is hiding in plain sight, but you got to have eyes to see. We all need. The Fully Alive came to me as a title because it so beautifully captured the power of human beings, even the most vulnerable. And the teachers in this book are teachers to say, you've got a joy in you, and you've got an exuberance in you, and you've got a faith in you. Let it out, you know. Don't spend another day only half alive. That's what they told me, and I hope that's what the book Fully Alive gives to readers, a chance to say, wow. You know, if he can run his race that way, you know, I too can look out for my best friends. I too can look out for those closest to me with a reckless disregard for how the world sees it, but with a reckless compassion for how I want to live my life.
Were you involved in it as a kid? And
not
all
in 1968.
The
I mean, I was there at Camp Shriver, which is in Rockville, Maryland, and was one of the pioneering efforts in this regard. And I was a little boy out taking pony rides and playing kickball games and swimming races in my backyard. But I, of course, the age of 4 and 5 and 6, had no idea what was really going on. I didn't know where these other kids had come from.
By 1995, actually, you're running the thing, right?
By 1995, yeah.
This was at Yale?
Yeah, the World Games were at Yale. I mean, the thing about Special Olympics, as your emailer said, you know, we do 80,000 games a year, if you can imagine, all over the world. 80,000 Special Olympics events a year. 4 million athletes.
I had no idea. 80,000.
1 million athletes in China who are participating in Special Olympics every year. There are 1 million athletes in India, even in the rural and some of the most poor and isolated parts of that country, that are participating. I mean, and this is all done by volunteers. It sounds like I'm tooting my own horn. I'm not. I'm tooting the horn of the human spirit. These are 99.9% of the workforce is volunteers. And why do they come back? It doesn't matter whether they're Hindu or Buddhist or Catholic or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or North or South or communist or capitalist or African or Latin or European or Middle Eastern. They come. They come to these little simple events. They come to line the field, to serve a glass of water, to cheer at the finish line, to put a medal on an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 22-year-old or a 32-year-old who's just done his race walk or just finished her swim. Why? Because they see this beautiful human spirit unleashed from all the stigma and all the shame and all the fear that inhabits so much of our lives. And they go, wow, volunteer after volunteer, millions of them say to themselves, I want to live here. I want to stay here.
Is that a legacy of your mother, a legacy of Rosemary?
Rosemary Kennedy, today. They won't know her name. They probably haven't seen her picture. They don't need to read this book. What they need to do is keep teaching all of us how to live fully alive.
Who was Loretta Claiborne?
Loretta Claiborne is kind of, I suppose, my guru, my mentor now in life. She's a woman born with an intellectual disability, born the housing projects of York, Pennsylvania, a mom who's on state assistance, born mentally retarded, partially blind, wasn't able to walk until she was 4. Her mother, the social workers came to her in that era in the 50s and 60s and took her to Eastern State, the Pennsylvania State Institution, which at the time housed, I think, about 7,000 people. And little Loretta remembers putting on her dress and packing her little suitcase and jumping in the car of the social worker with her mother to go off and live the rest of her life in an institution. And the irony is that when little Loretta got there, her life was so horrible. She was made fun of and beaten up and ridiculed so maliciously that she said to her mother, I want to stay here. I don't ever want to go back. I don't want to live in my neighborhood anymore. So an institution to a little child could look like
a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. But her mother knew better. Her mother brought her home and told her brother to look out for her, just as my grandparents told President Kennedy and Bob Kennedy and Ted Kennedy to look out for their sister, Eunice and Jean and Pat and Kathleen and so on, to look out. And they did. Her brother did look out for her, but it didn't help. She was thrown out of school. She was beaten up. She was called a retard, a bozo, a four eyes. She was thrown off of almost everything until one person came along and said, "The only thing I see you like to do, Loretta, is run." And she said, "Yeah, but I..." But she was so angry she didn't want to come. And then she went to... Her mother pressed...
She didn't want to come to the Olympics.
She didn't want to come to Special Olympics, and her mother forced her. And it was just a local event. And by the second time she looked up, and she describes it to me in the book, she looked up and she ran her race, and she saw people cheering for her. And she almost thought, this isn't real. No one has ever cheered for me. No one. No one. But they're cheering for me. And she thought to herself, this is a place I want to live.
How did you get to know her?
Well, she came. She was a volunteer, you know, and Loretta's quiet, but brilliant. She's understated, but intensely wise. She's doesn't say a lot, but she observes with a deep eye. And, you know, she was volunteering at our games, and I was a nervous wreck. And one day the governor's going to come in and inspect everything, and I was racing around, anxious, biting my nails, barking at people, acting like a petulant, irresponsible, terrified executive, which is exactly what I was. And, you know, I barked at someone, you know, hurry up, get this done, get that done. I mean, like a lot of us live our lives at work. At least, I mean, I fear like I have to tell that, but I don't think I'm alone. And she just turned to me, just picked her moment, and said, "You know, Tim, the governor puts his pants on in the morning the same way as everybody
else." She said this to you?
She said to me. And I was like, "I know that." You know. But then I thought to myself, you know what she's trying to say to me? She's trying to have me hear. Don't be afraid. He's another man. If she had been afraid, she wouldn't have been there, right? If she'd allowed the idea that he's more powerful than her to control her life the way it was controlling mine, she would have given up. She knew better. She knew we're all the same. She wasn't afraid of the governor. She wasn't afraid of me. She wasn't afraid of anybody. She wasn't disrespectful, but she could all of a sudden cut through the moment.
Did it help you in the moment?
It helped me a little bit, but I'm a slow learner. So I'm still, I still call Loretta a couple times a year, and she visits several times a year, and I still have to ask her advice on how to live. And I think this book will allow her voice in some sense to reach other people like me who are looking for balance, looking for a center, looking for a way to be calm amidst all the distractions. I mean, we live in such a distracted world. Loretta is one of these geniuses of finding your center amidst distraction. And I hope that's at least for me was one important step to finding myself feeling more fully alive.
Timothy Shriver, you mentioned China and the Special Olympics held there. This is a baby Pearl next. I want to ask you about who's...
Well, this was a, you know, an email I received one morning. You know, you turn on our computers and get your what's in your inbox. And one morning I received an email from very broken English. It was sent out to about 15 or 20 people from someone I didn't know. It described a man saying he had just had a baby in China, very broken. But he said, someone tell him baby has Down syndrome. So he writes, tough world. But he says, I want to cure her. Does anyone know how? And then he closes his email by saying, you know, I'm having a hard time, persevere, because people tell me to kill the baby, but I don't want to. Please help. And I thought to myself, I reread it four or five times. Did he write in this email, people tell me, kill the baby? And he did write those words. And the sad part is that when we look at disability rights, when we look at the life course of people with intellectual differences, when we look at the life course of most people with differences around the world, it's still very tough. We need a foreign policy. We need an human rights policy that accepts the idea that intellectual disability, that disability more broadly, needs to be included in our conversations. We shouldn't just judge governments based on their constitutions and based on their, you know, their treatment of the environment or their treatment of prisoners' rights, these are all very important things, and freedom of speech and so on and so forth. We ought to also engage with governments on the way in which we treat people who have great vulnerabilities but also great gifts. This particular dad perseveres. He names his baby. A volunteer comes and tells a Special Olympics volunteer, the great Dickon Young, visits him that very day. We were able to reach that volunteer who went out and told him, took pictures of the baby, and you're gonna love this child. And the story has a beautiful ending. Sadly, little baby Pearl didn't live long, but she flourished. She walked. She smiled. She visited with people. She stood up and showed the world who she was. She had terribly, sadly, heart challenges. But she became the darling of our movement. Her picture radiated across emails around the Special Olympics world, and she died before the age of 3. But it's another reminder that to live fully alive, you don't have to live long. You just have to live fully embracing the life you've been given.
What kind of a grade do you give the United States for progress and accepting, including people with special needs?
Well, I think we're certainly much better. I mean, I'm very big on the idea of judging people on improvement, not on abstract norms. This country has improved a lot. But like a lot of social change movements, we've done more to improve the law than we have to improve our attitudes. We still think of a person with special needs. I mean, look, people with Down's, I mean, I had a mom say to me, look, I have 2 sons. One is a banker and one is at home with me and will live his whole life in my care. And when I tell people that, they always say to me, I'm sorry. And she turned to me and she said, your job is to tell them to stop saying that. She said, I love both my sons equally and they both light up my life. And I can't stand it when people tell me, I'm sorry about your son. Our hearts still need to be opened to the idea that your IQ score is not a measure of your value, that your capacity to run fast is not a measure of your Olympic qualities, that your capacity to read or give a speech isn't a measure of how much you can contribute to the world, that the human spirit really, I think of myself in some ways as an educator of the heart because my heart has been cracked open by so many human beings who have told me that the most important lessons are lessons of the heart. We should teach them. I hope this book starts helping people to see that being fully alive isn't about what's on your business card. It's about what's inside.
Hmm. You know, you only reluctantly wrote about Rosemary Kennedy, right?
That's true. Yes.
But, I mean, when you consider her influence in all of this and the number of people who have been affected by her.
Yeah.
Her spirit through your mother, through President Kennedy, through all the people who have volunteered over the years through Special Olympics. I mean, that's quite a legacy.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful to think that this person who was almost, you know, we see this in great artists, great writers. During their lifetimes, no one knew them. You know, you read about painters whose paintings are selling for millions of dollars, but when they died penniless. Rosemary's a little bit that kind of a human being. You know, her story still teaches. Her life still instructs. Her spirit still carries a powerful message. I hope people read this book not just to read about her, but to read about themselves and to rediscover the best in themselves and to, in a sense, commit themselves to living the life, the unique life that each of them, each reader, is given to lead, knowing that most of us won't face the challenges Loretta Claiborne faced or that Rosemary Kennedy faced or that little baby Pearl faced, but all of us can live fully alive.
Fully Alive is Timothy Shriver's story of the Kennedy families and his relationship to the Special Olympics. Timothy Shriver still serves as chairman of Special Olympics. The book is published by Sarah Crichton Books, which is under the imprint of FSG, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Giroux.
Yeah. Thank you, Timothy. Nice to have you on the show. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's the first hour of Midday. We have another hour of the show coming up. Right now, we'll take a break for lunch, brought to us by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood in Baltimore. Also at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. It's really good, Tim says. Yeah, he had some before the show. A short break. We'll be back after the news.